I guess it will be largely how we can get better mileage out of the activities we're already doing. In a sense, there's nothing world-shattering about it at all. It strikes me as being so obvious, but very, very often it's the obvious things that have to be said. Because a lot of us have activities in our churches, and we're going, oh, terrific. Sorry, I can't return the compliment. Okay. let's fix that. I was actually going to speak this morning on the use of wise words. Let's get into it, hey? Proverbs chapter 10. Our work at Murray, there's no formula. What there is a lot of hard work, a lot of self-sacrifice, and basically a change of lifestyle so that we are more oriented towards our non-Christian friends than towards pleasing ourselves. And we've got a whole lot of families that most of our churches are reaching into through kids' clubs, Sunday schools, IRE, youth group, and you name it. But we're not really seeing much progress in most of our churches. So that really, I suppose, is what we'd like to talk about. And I think it's relevant to you. So as Noel said, we're not going to stand up and give you a lecture. But what we would like to do is talk about some of the things that we've found helpful. So Gay and I'll both be participating, and you'll be participating. And I hope it's a worthwhile time. So that's 3 o'clock to whenever it finishes. It can't finish too late because I've got to be preaching at Wavell Heights by 7. So it won't go for 4 hours. I would think that once these things get wound up, they do tend to go along a bit. So I should think that allowing for the fact that somebody's going to come late and you're going to mess around for 5 minutes or so, it'll be between 4:30 and 5 o'clock that we'd wrap it up. I got a little bit out of kilter myself a couple of weeks ago in my morning talk, because I did give a bit of background towards to the wisdom literature and the Proverbs, which didn't leave me enough time to look at the body of the book and the sorts of Proverbs that we're familiar with. And I thought that I was going to get a bit more out of that. Now, what I've done, I've changed things a bit, and so this morning I'm going to go back and we're going to look at the body of the book again, a couple of other subjects. Because the subject I had this morning, which was the last couple of chapters, the non-Hebrew wisdom, if I just spoke on that, it would really, I think, be a bit unbalanced. So the talk that I had prepared for the first part of the first few chapters and for those last few chapters, that can all keep for some other time. And at least I think we'll get more out of this central part of the book from chapter 10 through to, say, chapter 27, which is really what we're most familiar with. I mentioned last week two topics, one of which was work and laziness, things relating to whether you work or whether you don't, whether you're diligent or whether you're not. And the other side of the coin was to do with ambition. And I had to really skate through it fairly quickly. But the point that I was making was something like this. I think we mentioned a few times that although we may not want to be rich, that should not be an excuse for laziness. And good, honest work is valuable in its own right, and we ought to be doing it, whether we're rich or whether we're not. There's no excuse for laziness. On that score, I noticed that Ian doesn't seem to be here this morning. He seemed to get a bit of ribbing over the fact that he was a public servant. So, I'm not saying this in defense of Ian, because I don't know if he's worth defending, but I'll assume that he is. But in defense of the situation in general, I worked in the public service for 4 years before I went to Bible college and then came home from Bible college and got married, and worked back again for another 4 years before we went overseas. And those 8 years, particularly the second 4, were very fulfilling. I found them very rewarding, thoroughly enjoyable, and very fulfilling in terms of what you accomplish for people and so on. So I just thought I'd throw that one in to balance out some of the comments that fly around. I should think that most Christians would find the work they're doing fulfilling if they're doing it in the right attitude, doesn't matter who you're working for, that a Christian approach to work will be valuable in its own right and will bring its own rewards. Now, the problem with that led me to the second part of my talk a couple of weeks ago, which was the problem of ambition. Because if we're not very careful, we can become diligent in our work, which we're supposed to be anyway, but that diligence can lead us to become greedy and to be obsessed with work or with grandiose living or cash or whatever it might be. And sometimes Christians can hide behind their Christian conscientiousness as a sort of justification for their own greed or indulgence for selfish reasons. So that's why I think when we talk about being diligent and honest and hardworking, we ought also to say, but let us not become selfishly ambitious. There's nothing wrong with ambition, but there's a lot wrong with selfish ambition. I should think that ordinary ambition is part of the outcome of our desire to do well in the things that have been given to us to do. We want to do them well. Selfish ambition, which is what the Bible condemns, is when we trample all over other people in the process of achieving our own goals. Now, one of the things that the book of Proverbs does is that it draws a line between ordinary ambition and selfish ambition. Because what we're getting in Proverbs, although I said it was a book of very down-to-earth statements, very down-to-earth matters that are discussed, it is not a purely worldly wisdom. It's not just a pragmatic sort of a wisdom. It's not common sense. It's more than just common sense, because ordinary common sense, if it's not sanctified, if it's not acted upon by the Word of God, can become a very self-serving thing. The Bible, sure, it's got common sense, but it's common sense that's based on the fear of the Lord. So what we're having here in the book of Proverbs, in the case of work, what I've just talked about, or if you're just talking about wisdom in general, it's not just ordinary wisdom, it's spiritual wisdom, which again is what is talked about in the New Testament, in the book of James, about having spiritual wisdom, not just worldly wisdom. Now, Christians might have wisdom, but sometimes the wisdom is not necessarily spiritual, it's just worldly, with a few texts stuck on the end of it to make it look Christian. And sometimes you'll meet people who get on in this life, they're academically inclined, they're intelligent enough, and they can trot out things that sound all very impressive. But when you analyse it, it's not much different from the thinking of the non-Christian person. Just got a few Bible texts thrown in to make it look good. The Christian wisdom is something that is entirely different. It comes from an entirely different set of values, an entirely different perspective, a whole different lifestyle. We were staying with somebody recently, Gay and I, in the country, Christian people. We were both very impressed with the spiritual wisdom of this particular person. One who is not academically inclined in any way whatsoever, nothing sophisticated in terms of the climate of the age, but because his mind, thinking, attitudes, behaviour and lifestyle had been saturated by an understanding of the Bible, he had what I would consider to be spiritual wisdom. Whereas you'll get other people who are fairly with it in terms of academic, business or social structures of our society. They're Christians and that they can talk fairly fluently, but the so-called wisdom is really just a regurgitation of the standard line that's peddled by the sort of secular humanist society, but with a few verses thrown in to dress it up. Now, that's not spiritual wisdom. This wisdom we're talking about is within reach of everybody, regardless of academic ability, regardless of social standing, regardless of business acumen or whatever. Spiritual wisdom, it starts with a fear of the Lord, and it is built through an understanding of the Bible. And so the Bible transforms our thoughts, not Channel 9 or whatever. Now, we looked at a couple of topics last time, and I'm going to look at a couple more topics today. And this is one way I suggest you treat the book. Just go through it and trace a few topics through. Select yourself a few chapters. It's so big that you'll get boggled, mind-boggled, if you try to do everything at once. So just select yourself three or four chapters and concentrate on following through one or two themes. I mentioned half a dozen last week. Well, one of them I've got today is words. That was where we started this morning. Think before you speak. Now, I've given you, I suppose, a bit of an example this morning of how we ought to think before we speak. And that's what we're going to talk about here. the Christian use of our words. Let's start at chapter 10, verse 14. Wise people lay up knowledge, but the babbling of a fool brings ruin near. Which means we oughtn't to try to accumulate knowledge immediately, as if somehow I'm going to do a crash course and come out with the knowledge of the Bible at the end of 3 weeks. There's no substitute for this constant, steady building in the teaching of the church, in our private readings, day by day, or whatever, a regular commitment to storing up knowledge. There's no sense saying, oh, that book doesn't grab me at present because it's not relevant to me. That's a very short-sighted view to take. It may not be relevant right now, but it might be relevant in 12 or 18 months' time. And what we're to do is to store up knowledge so that when the crisis comes, we're not looking silly because we're not in a position to meet it. This popular notion that everything's got to be relevant to us today is really a fairly immature notion. And so go right through the Bible. All the books that look as if they're not attractive, all the things that look as if they don't really mean much to you right now, never mind. Stack your mind full of what the Bible is saying. Wise people store up knowledge so that when the occasion arises, they are in some sort of condition to meet the need. It's a bit too late when the crisis descends and you find yourself ill-equipped. On the other hand, you've got these babbling fools who just bring trouble for themselves and for others. Go across to verse 18. He who conceals hatred has lying lips. That doesn't mean to say that we're to shoot our mouths and just express our feelings without thoughts for other people. But what it means is that if we're putting on a nice show and looking as if we're all very friendly and all the rest of it, and underneath we can't stand, you know, we really hate the person, we've got animosity there built up within, then they say that is wrong. So we are to control the way we speak, but we're not to be hypocrites in doing so. So we are not to just burst in and blast somebody because we don't like them or whatever, but neither are we to flatter them and yet underneath be thinking something entirely the opposite. You can be truthful and Christian and honest and gracious all at the same time. This is not against being truthful. This is against being a hypocrite. And if you are for a slander, you're a fool. When words are many, transgression is not lacking. We all know this. I mean, goodness me, we all know that the more you talk, the more mistakes you make. But he who restrains his lips is prudent. That's verse 19. Use words wisely, sparingly, because the more you talk, the more strife you get yourself into. Which is no excuse now for just shutting up and coming to the big silent act. Rather, let's think about what we're doing and saying. Go down to chapter 12. Verse 14. Chapter 12, verse 14. Remember I said last time I had a few things I wanted to give you, but I didn't have time on the previous occasion. I said one of the things that we suggested was that people might like to make their own brief summary or just draw a little one-liner out of some of these proverbs. Verse 14, from the fruit of his words, a man is satisfied with good. And the work of a man's hand comes back to him. So my little one-liner out of this is that honest speech, like honest work, brings its own satisfaction. Well, that's what he's saying, I think, verse 14. The fruit of a person's words, through that a person is satisfied with good. So there's something rewarding in itself. You're not speaking wholesome words simply for the sake of flattering people, nor for the sake of getting flattery from people. You're doing it because it's a good thing to do. But the very fact that you've done something worthwhile like that brings its own reward. From the fruit of a person's words, he's satisfied with good. And likewise our work, which is what I was talking about earlier. The work of a person's hands comes back to him. Nobody else might see it. But you've done something well, as unto the Lord. And just in doing that, and in doing it well, it has been its own reward, so to speak. Go down to verse 18. Here's another one about words, how they can injure. And we all know that. This is a frightful sort of a subject to speak on, because anybody who speaks on it knows that he or she is guilty of things just as much as anybody else. So these are not my instructions to you. All I'm simply doing is reading the Word of God, and I trust taking notice of it myself as much as I'd like all of us to take notice of it. We realize that words can injure, verse 18, words can injure. Words can injure much more than a fist or a sharp weapon or something like that. Words are like sword thrusts. But the tongue of the wise brings healing. And that's a ministry that we ought to be encouraging and developing, using our words to bring healing and encouragement. Truthful lips in verse 19 will endure forever, but a lying tongue is but for a moment. Lies. People are much less hung up over lies than they used to be. And I'm afraid sometimes Christians are not much different. That you find Christians become, again, influenced by the spirit of the age where people can lie without batting an eyelid. And before we know where we are, our standards have slipped. So there's a little reminder in verse 19. The lying tongue is but for a moment. My little one-liner is that it brings temporary relief, but lasting shame. Get you out of a tight corner, and within 2 minutes, you're feeling guilty and ashamed for the rest of the day. A lying tongue is but for a moment, but truthful lips endure forever. Verse 19. Down to verse 23. A prudent man conceals his knowledge, but fools proclaim their folly. In other words, you open your mouth and give yourself away. People talk, and they would have been much better to have kept quiet. There's another one a bit further on like that. Go down to chapter 15, verse 1. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh words stir up anger. I think there's a proverb later on that says, I don't think it was in our lot to read, but it's something about for lack of fuel, a fire goes out or something. Yeah, for lack of wood, the fire goes out. But where there is no whisperer, quarrelling will cease. But as long as you keep on whispering and talking and making little side comments and innuendos and so on, the thing just keeps on festering. You just keep the thing going. Well, here we're told that the soft answer can turn away wrath, but harsh words are going to stir it up. And we should be working for the sort of speech and intercommunications that is going to improve relationships, not make them harder. The tongue of the wise in verse 2 dispenses knowledge, but the mouths of fools pour out folly. Words can either cheer or hurt, so we ought to then think carefully about what we say. Let's go down to verse 12. A scoffer does not like to be reproved. He will not go to the wise. In other words, he readily criticizes others, but he's not very open-eared when it comes to listening to the criticisms of others that they might have of him. So a scoffer is one who criticizes regularly, cynical and all the rest of it. He doesn't like to be reproved. So if you and I are inclined to make uncharitable comments or critical comments or cynical comments about others, we ought to be at least prepared to listen to the comments that others make of us. We might learn something. Nobody likes being criticized. Nobody runs around and says, oh boy, I'd love to get criticized today. It'd be terrific if three or four people came to me and started criticizing. Nobody likes criticism, but if we're sensible, we will learn from it. And even though our initial reaction is going to be negative and we're going to stand up and defend ourselves, I think if we think a little bit longer and control our tongue for a while, we might learn something from the reproof or the advice or the criticism. So that's verse 12, file it away. Here's verse 18, a hot-tempered person stirs up strife. Well, we know that. Let's go across to chapter 16, verse 21. The wise of heart is called a man of discernment, and pleasant speech increases persuasiveness. The wise of heart is called a man of discernment, and pleasant speech increases persuasiveness. You've more or less got four things here. You start off with wisdom, which produces discernment. Discernment will then produce helpful talk or helpful speech, and that in turn will increase our persuasiveness. It's a very feet on the ground approach to some practicalities of life, isn't it? That there's no doubt our words are very influential. And if you want to be persuasive in the right sense, then you ought to start by being a person of wisdom. Learn to be discerning in working out what is worthwhile and what's worthless. That will in turn help our speech to be constructive and in turn bring useful things. Nothing hypocritical about that, nothing selfishly ambitious about that. That's just a sensible way of making our lives more worthwhile in the cause of Christ. Verse 23, the mind of the wise makes his speech judicious. Think before you talk, in other words. There'll be an inner quality to our lives if we've educated our minds. And the Bible has a lot to say about the mind. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. Don't be conformed to the world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. Don't let the newspaper and the television and the radio and your workmates be the influences that are moulding your thinking. Let your thinking be moulded by what you know of Christ, by what you know of the Bible. Be transformed by the renewal of your mind, and then you'll know what the will of God is. Now the mind in verse 23, the mind of the wise is going to make his speech judicious, and it's going to add persuasiveness to his lips. So there's another indication of how our words can help or hinder. Therefore, let us devote ourselves to the proper development of use of words. Pleasant speeches like honeycomb and so on. We better skip over a couple more here. Chapter 17, verse 27. I'm just skating over the top of these, as you probably observed, but I hope we at least ring a bell here or there that we can learn something from, but also maybe you can follow through one or two of the other topics that I mentioned. Verse 27, he who restrains his words has knowledge, and he who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding. Even a fool who keeps silent is considered wise. When he closes his lips, he's even thought intelligent. Have you and I ever been in situations like that, where all these heavies around are all talking about stuff, and you're thinking, good, they don't ask me what I think about this. So if you manage to keep quiet, they might even think you're intelligent. If they ask you to speak, you might simply expose your ignorance. Well, we've all been in situations like that, I'm sure, which is no excuse for remaining ignorant, but it does tell us that thinking before you speak is a wise course of action. And we've all been in cases also where somebody, the only way he can think is by opening his mouth and letting sound come out of it, and so he sort of fills the room with constant words, and the more he talks, the more he's displaying his ignorance. So even a fool who keeps silent might be considered intelligent. So once again, think before you speak. It might be a step towards wisdom. Verse 2 of the next chapter is a good one. A fool takes no pleasure in understanding, only in expressing his own opinion. He's got a closed mind, but an open mouth. That's my little one-liner. That's not entirely original, that one incidentally. I found it somewhere else, but there it is. The first half of the verse, he's got a closed mind, he's got no pleasure in understanding, but the second half, he's got an open mouth. All he's interested is in expressing his opinion. We'll go across to chapter 26. I really want to draw your attention to a couple here in verses 4 and 5, because it illustrates a point that I made last week, and that is that you mustn't say, oh, the Bible's full of contradictions, or that the Bible says this in verse so-and-so, and I know some case where it doesn't apply. People are very wooden the way they apply the Bible, and particularly the book of Proverbs. I mentioned a couple last week. Like even in English, we say, too many cooks spoil the broth, but many hands make light work. And so if you want people to make light work of a heavy job, get a lot doing it. But then, you know, people get these two apparently contradictory sayings back to front. The wisdom of using Proverbs is to use the proverb in the right setting, in the right occasion. And we know that there are some occasions when you don't want 50 people trying to do a small job, and then there are other occasions when you do want as many as possible helping. So you use the right saying for the right occasion. And that's part of the wisdom of using the Word of God anyway. But it's more obvious in Proverbs, because I've heard people latch onto one particular proverb and hang on to that in all circumstances, and it wasn't written for all circumstances. It was written concerning certain things that you might do in certain circumstances. But in other circumstances, you may do something entirely different. Now take verses 4 and 5 of chapter 26. totally contradictory. In verse 4, answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you become as silly as he is. Verse 5, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. Now, they're saying completely opposite things. But in some cases, it's better not to answer a fool according to his folly. Don't cast your pearls before swine, if I can adapt a saying of Jesus, because he's only trying to get the mickey out of you. So, be wise. There are other occasions when you do answer a fool according to his folly, because it's the only way of making him see sense. Paul did this when he wrote to some of the mad Corinthians at the end of chapter, the last four chapters of 2 Corinthians. Well, he was answering them the same sort of stupidity that they were throwing at him. And he said, I'm a bit of a fool for talking like this, but it's the only language you understand, so here I go. Fool to fool, I hope you understand. Now that's what he's saying here in verse 5. Answer a fool according to his folly, otherwise he might think he's so great. That's one way of cutting him down to size. But there are other occasions, verse 4, when it's wise to keep silent. Okay, so much for words. Now just let's whip through a few having to do with our neighbours' social relationships. Let's go back to chapter 11. I'll whip through these fairly quickly. And so my two topics here for today were my words and my neighbour. Now, other topics, as I mentioned, you can have things like parenting, you can have things like education, discipline, work, we mentioned that before, suburban life. There's a lot here about suburban life, how you get on with your neighbours, things about eating habits, and so it goes on. Well, this now, let's talk about my relationships with my neighbour, verse 9. With his mouth, the godless man destroys his neighbour, but by knowledge the righteous are delivered. And so here again you've got the wrong usage of words, and we're destroying other people. When it goes well with the righteous, the city rejoices. But when the wicked perish, there are shouts of gladness. And you and I can identify with that. There are some people who are so foul that they're not fit to live on this earth, it seems. The grotesque things that they do. And when justice is done, I think, well, good. It's about time justice was done with some of these characters. And so when the wicked perish, there are shouts of gladness, and so there ought to be. But when the righteous prosper, sometimes the righteous get the rough end of the pineapple, and it really is very disappointing. But sometimes you see the righteous prosper, and you think, good, it's good to see a good person get through. And so the city rejoices. Verse 12, he who belittles his neighbour lacks sense, but a man of understanding remains silent. Belittling your neighbour is about the most foolish way to try to feel superior. Simply by comparing ourselves with somebody else, putting him down so that I can go up, that would have to be the most self-deceptive practice around. Because we all are better than somebody if we choose the right people to compare ourselves with. And that's what we do, unfortunately. We normally compare ourselves with people that we know we're better than, and so that makes us feel good. It's a stupid thing to do. We belittle other people, and of course, in the process, we deceive ourselves and build up a false value on our own importance. Let's go down to verse 26. People curse the person who holds back grain, but they bless the person who sells it. This is talking about hoarding commodities that are in short supply in a time of need. And boy, I tell you, this is a real thing in Asia, in Thailand where we live, where certain merchants would have warehouses full of certain commodities, forcing the price up. And I think it's probably a great problem right through the commercial world, particularly in the developing world, where it's a way of ripping off the poor, hoarding in a time of scarcity, so that the price goes up and you get rich while a lot of other people can't even get the basic necessities. No wonder people curse the person who holds back grain, that they give a blessing upon the person who sells it. Lots of things like that, incidentally, through the book of Proverbs. Go to chapter 17, verse 17. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. We've heard of that before. We all know that it's in the time of need you find out who your true friends are. Chapter 19, verse 17. I've got another one not jotted down here. He who is kind to the poor lends to the Lord, and he will repay him for his deed. A lot of poor people in the world, I think we hardly need to be reminded of it, but how much do we make sacrifices to help them? He who is kind to the poor lends to the Lord. The Lord has a special interest in the poor and the needy of the world. And I'm constantly trying to think of ways, so you increase the percentage of your giving, not just the amount, you try to increase the percentage all the time to give more away, and then you try to think of, you know, what else can you do? I thought recently, fairly irrational thought it was, I thought, well, all these people have stuffed junk mail in somebody's letterbox. Maybe, you know, you could do that to get some more money to send to some poor folks in Africa, and then you sort of sit down and work it out, and you think of all the things you're already doing, and the small return you get, and you think, well, that's not a very sensible utilization of my time. But, you know, these things come through your head, because you're trying to think, how can you help the poor? Boy, I reckon that the West has got a lot to answer for. Here we are gobbling up, what is it, 95% of the world's resources or whatever, and yet you've got all the rest of the people. There's no simple answer. I'm not saying we should all go and walk around in a hair shirt and bare feet and eat dried orange peel or something like that. But on the other hand, we've got to somehow find some way, haven't we, of shelling a bit more of it out to those who are in need. Remember Jesus in Matthew 25, they said, oh, when do we give to the poor? I mean, when do we give to you, rather? Or when do we visit you in jail? Or feed you when you are hungry? Or give you something when you are thirsty? Or visit you when you are sick? And Jesus said, well, insofar as you did it to these, the least of my brethren, you did it to me. Jesus had a special interest in these people also. He who is kind to the poor lends to the Lord, and be assured the Lord will repay him for his deeds, second part of the verse. Now the other side of the coin is in chapter 21, verse 13. He who closes his ear to the cry of the poor will himself cry out and not be heard, meaning that God doesn't particularly satisfy the needs of those who are selfish. There's another one in chapter 22, verse 16. He who oppresses the poor to increase his own wealth or gives to the rich will only come to want. This is a person who is, his sole concern is economic gain. He's greedy and he rips off the poor to increase his own wealth, or he gives to the rich, meaning the people that he can get favours from. He's bribing them or oiling their palm in some way to buy favours from them. Well, you can see God's values there again, which all of this doesn't sort of sit very well with 20th century society in Australia. And that's why I think Christians have got to have a different value system from what the average person has. We better wrap this up. Let's go across to chapter 25, verse 16. Greed destroys. That's my little summary of verse 16. Greed destroys. If you have found honey, eat only enough for yourself, lest you be sated with it and vomit it. Verse 17 is a good practical one. Let your foot be seldom in your neighbour's house, otherwise he might become tired of you and throw you down the front steps. Which doesn't quite say that, but it more or less is the same thrust. Come down to verse 19. Trust in a faithless man in a time of trouble, it's like a bad tooth or a foot that slips. Somebody who lets you down. You thought this person was reliable and they have let you down badly. Or verse 20 is another misfit. The person who sings songs to a heavy heart, he's like one who takes off a garment on a cold day or puts vinegar on a wound. Not a very charitable character at all. He's flippant at the wrong time. And like a person that strips you bare when it's freezing cold or pours vinegar on a wound. There's a time to sing happy songs and there's a time not to sing happy songs. So, verse 21, if your enemy is hungry, give him bread to eat. If he's thirsty, give him water to drink. For you'll heap coals of fire on his head and the Lord will reward you. We all thought that was a New Testament teaching because it's found in Romans chapter 12. But there it is right in the Old Testament. The Old Testament doesn't teach people to be vindictive. The Old Testament teaches people to clothe the needy, to be kind to your enemies, and so on. But let's conclude again by just reading a few words from Jesus who said, I tell you, a greater than Solomon is here. That's the wisdom of Solomon. All those that we've just read come from Solomon. Well, here are a few words from one who is greater than Solomon. He's saying something the same, but he's driving it home a little harder. You've heard it said, you shall love your neighbour and hate your enemy. That's what was said. It wasn't in the Bible, but that was what the rabbis said. Well, Jesus said, I'm saying to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be the sons of your Father who is in heaven. After all, he makes his sun rise upon the evil and on the good. He sends his rain upon the just and upon the unjust. If you love only those who love you, what reward have you? Even the tax collectors, the pimps, the prostitutes, the bookies, the madams who run brothels and so on, even those love people of their own ilk. If you only love people of your own ilk, just stick to friends in the church and that share your values and so on. If that's the total circle of your friendship, well, what reward is there in that? Even these other crooks and unsavory characters do that. If you salute only your brethren, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? You, therefore, must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. That's a hard saying, but we dare not water down what Jesus has told us. There's our standard, our Father in heaven, exemplified in human flesh in Jesus Christ.